It had been a quiet fall evening in the upscale coastal California community of Soquel when the calls came in. There was smoke billowing from the top of a small mountain ridge. Firefighters made their way to the area, carefully navigating the windy and precarious road cut out of the side of the mountain that led up to a brand new mansion.
When they got to the top, they would find the entrance to the driveway blocked. It would seem that someone had intentionally left a vehicle parked horizontally across the driveway. That was the first sign of something nefarious going on. The collection of mannequin-looking corpses in the backyard pool would be the next.
Warning, this podcast contains graphic content that may not be suitable for all listeners. All suspects or persons of interest discussed on this podcast are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Listener discretion advised.
Residents in Santa Cruz, California, experienced their fair share of brutal and notorious serial killers during the 1970s. In fact, in just the first 3 years of that decade, three different brutal killers struck, murdering at least 36 people within the Quiet Beach community.
Two of them you've probably heard about. Edmund Kemper, the soft-spoken giant known as the Coed Killer, has been covered extensively in documentaries, books, and podcasts. And Herbert Mullen, the paranoid schizophrenic who believed bloodshed would delay a major earthquake, has been studied intensely by criminal psychologists. However, just before they entered the scene, there was another guy, dubbed the Killer Prophet. He was responsible for a mass killing at the home of a prominent eye doctor. It had all of the hallmarks of being carried out by a cult, and people were gripped with fear that this could be yet another violent hippie commune, like the Manson family. The Ota family massacre had happened in the aftermath of the Tate and LaBianca murders in Los Angeles. As you can imagine, it was a wild few years for the Santa Cruz district attorney, a young guy named Peter Chang, who, in just a few short years, prosecuted the cases against Edmund Kemper, Herbert Mullen, and the killer in today's case. At one point, he referred to the region as Murdersville, USA. An Associated Press reporter overheard that comment, took the statement, and ran with it. The next day, a big splashy headline in the newspaper read, "Santa Cruz, Murder Capital of the World."
It was Monday night in October of 1970. When the Live Oak Fire Department responded to the call. It was a residential fire in the unincorporated town of Soquel. As the fire trucks raced up the hill of North Rodeo Gulch Drive, they made their way to the remote and sprawling estate. It was the newly built home belonging to Dr. Victor Ota, a prominent local ophthalmologist. The mansion sat on top of a mountain ridge and overlooked the nearby wooded hills and a breathtaking view of Monterey Bay just below them. The mansion had been designed by a protege of famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright, and its Japanese influences complemented the peace and serenity of its surroundings. But on this night, the energy in the home was different. It was anxious, frantic, and hot. It was pitch black as the fire engine approached the secluded home, but shattering that darkness, they saw flames tearing through the roof. Their response was stalled for only a few moments, by a vehicle parked long ways across the driveway. A couple of them pushed it to the side so the crew could press on. The center of the home was heavily engulfed. The flames crackled as the firefighters ran around the back of the house in search of a water source. There, the fire reflected off of a large body of water, the pool. As soon as their flashlights shined on the water, what they saw stopped them in their tracks.
The fire chief would later tell a TV news reporter that he thought it was a mannequin at first, but then he saw the others and he knew this was a crime scene. The body of a woman was floating near the surface. She had been bound, gagged, and blindfolded with silk scarves. The water was stained with a darker hue around the edges where the blood had collected. Closer to the bottom of the pool were four more victims.
Police were called to the scene to begin an investigation. While the fire department focused on extinguishing the flames and trying to preserve as much of the evidence as possible, they set up security outside all of the entrances and began working the scene. It didn't take long to determine that it was four members of Dr. Ota's family and his secretary who had been murdered.
The Ota family was well-known and highly respected in the community. The father, 45-year-old Dr. Victor Ota, had built his fortune through hard work and sacrifice. He had been born to Japanese immigrants in Livingston, Montana. His parents had immigrated to the U.S. in search of better opportunities for their children. After Pearl Harbor, though, Victor's father was declared an enemy alien, like a lot of Japanese living in America had, and the family lost everything. Victor was attending Montana State College, now known as Montana State University, but when World War II rolled around, he and his brother decided to enlist. They both served, but sadly his brother, a pilot, was killed in combat.
After 2 years of service, Victor's time was up. He left the military and enrolled in medical school at Northwestern University in Illinois. And despite the all-consuming time he spent dedicated to school, he still managed to help out his parents financially. He would spend all day in class and then drive a cab at night just to make some extra money. Somewhere in between all of this, he met the love of his life, Virginia Tobias, who was working as a secretary for a local photographer. In 1951, they were married in Chicago after his graduation, and together they had a little boy. And then tragedy struck. The son caught a bad bout of pneumonia and passed away at just 18 months old. With the funeral costs, they were once again left struggling financially. But they pressed on and would eventually have four more children, daughters Tora and Lark, and then sons Derek and Taggart.
To support his growing family, Victor re-enlisted in the military and served as a flight surgeon. It was during this time that he flew over Santa Cruz on a mission. As he looked down at the dazzling California coast, he became enamored and decided this was the area where he wanted to live and raise his family. After several years, he resigned as a major, and the Ota family packed their things, loaded up their VW bus, and headed west. They arrived in Central California with a few handmade pieces of furniture and set up shop.
Dr. Ota established a practice, and it focused on cataract surgery, and it was an immediate success. At the time of his death, he was not only the busiest eye surgeon in California with two office locations, but he had a stellar reputation for being extremely generous and giving to charitable organizations. His daughter would later say, if his patients couldn't pay, he didn't worry about it, and he gave them the surgery they needed anyway. While he liked the finer things in life, things he had clearly worked hard for, his friends would later describe him as not only a friendly guy, but a really good one, with a magnanimous quality about him.
Miss Ota was said to be very similar, kind and giving. She, too, was a first-generation American and had been born to immigrants from Czechoslovakia. She integrated into this life of privilege with grace. Over the 10 years they had lived in Santa Cruz, she had become ingrained in the community and involved in many charitable causes. Her daughter would later remember just how stylish she was, with beautiful outfits that fit her thin figure, and just how her blonde hair was always perfectly done up. Neighbors who lived in the surrounding area said they knew her because she made a point to wave every morning as she drove her sons to school.
Their oldest daughter, 18-year-old Tora, was in college by this time, studying fashion design at a New York City art school. 15-year-old Lark was enrolled at an all-girls boarding school in Northern California, but she had taken advantage of a short break and came home to help decorate the house for the upcoming Halloween holiday. It was one of her father's favorite traditions, as he was known to carve dozens of pumpkins every single year. On Sunday, 43-year-old Virginia drove Lark back to school and dropped her off. It would be the last time Lark would see her mother. Only 24 hours later, Virginia would end up in the pool alongside her husband, Dr. Victor Ota.
Sadly, the boys, 12-year-old Derek and 11-year-old Taggart, weren't as lucky as their big sisters. Their bodies were pulled from the pool, along with a fifth victim, a 38-year-old woman named Dorothy Cadwallader. Dorothy was Dr. Ota's secretary, but also a close friend of the family who would often help out with the kids. She was a highly educated woman who helped to run Dr. Ota's prestigious practice, and she was also a mother.
Like the Otas, Dorothy had also lost a son. He was killed at the age of 8 while trying to play a trick on some of his friends. In an attempt to scare them, he laid down in a ditch, planning to pop up. But a postman, who couldn't see the boy, drove over the ditch, and he died from the injuries. Dorothy went on to adopt a little girl named Melinda. Understandably, Dorothy was a bit overprotective of her after the death of her son. Sadly, Melinda was only 11 years old when her mother was murdered. Dorothy has been described as a beautiful person inside and out, who had a dazzling sense of style and elegance.
Now, as police pulled the bodies of the five victims from the pool, they started to piece together what had transpired. Each victim had been bound with silk scarves, blindfolded, gagged, and had been shot at least once. Blood splatters found on the new flagstone patio told them at least some of the victims had been shot there, then pushed or dragged into the water.
Based on just a visual examination conducted at the scene, it appeared that neither Virginia nor Dorothy had been sexually assaulted, and each woman was still wearing all of their jewelry. After the flames were extinguished, only two of the 10 rooms remained fully intact, but a search of what had been left of the house revealed that nothing valuable seemed to have been stolen. And so this crossed two motives off the list, robbery and sexual gratification. During a search of the house, an eerie discovery was made. All of the phone cords had been cut. That pointed investigators to the theory that the killer, or killers, had likely premeditated the murders, cutting the lines before anyone was killed.
And then another haunting discovery was made, one that would spread fear amongst the public and also throughout the police department. There were two ways to access the property, and both had been blocked by vehicles. The secretary's Lincoln Continental was parked long ways at one end, and Dr. Ota's Rolls-Royce across the front of the other. Underneath the windshield of his car was a note with a crucifix on top. Police realized that not only did the crucifix belong to one of the daughters and that it had come from inside the home, but that the note had possibly been written on a typewriter found inside the home. Police picked up the note and read it. Halloween, 1970. Today, World War III will begin, as brought to you by the people of the free universe. From this day forward, anyone and or everyone or company of persons who misuse the natural environment or destroy same will suffer the penalty of death by the people of the free universe. I and my comrades, from this day forth, will fight until death or freedom against anyone who does not support natural life on this planet. Materialism must die, or mankind will stop. The note was signed Knight of Wands, Knight of Cups, Knight of Pentacles, Knight of Swords.
Initially, police believed the four knights might represent four different killers involved in this massacre. This theory was supported by several facts, one of which was that two different guns had been used to commit the murders, a .22 and a .38 caliber. And then there was the number of victims. Police didn't think it seemed likely that one person could control and overwhelm three adults and two children. But it was the note, the words used, and the further death it promised that shook investigators to their core. It sounded like a fanatical group, just like the group that existed only hours south of Santa Cruz, as the Manson family took part in the cold-blooded killings of pregnant actress Sharon Tate and four of her friends inside her house, followed by Leno and Rosemary Bianca the following night. The Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office was terrified that their city now had a group of deranged killers on the loose.
Right, and the Manson family trial was actually underway at the same time that the killings were carried out in Santa Cruz. So you have to remember how vicious those killings were down in Los Angeles. Some of the victims were stabbed dozens of times. Some were beaten with guns, shot, or even hanged alive by complete strangers. It captivated global headlines. And then there were the similarities between the Manson family massacres and the Ota family massacre. Both sets of victims belonged to high society and were well-to-do. In both cases, the phone lines had been cut and some of the victims bound. Then there was the note mentioning the people of the free universe in Santa Cruz, which hinted that the killers could be a cult or from an extremist hippie community. And down in Los Angeles, somebody had left the phrase helter skelter written in blood at one of the crime scenes.
Not wanting to scare the community until they knew more, the police initially held off on mentioning that the note was found at the scene of the crime. But they did publicly release information on two other clues that were found. A green 1968 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser that belonged to Virginia was missing, along with one of Victor's .22 caliber firearms. The description of the car quickly made its way into the news reports, asking for the public's help and to keep an eye out for it.
Now, the public didn't need to know about the note to catch on to the possible hippie cult connection. There had already been this division between the so-called straights and the hippies in many American communities, and comparisons to the Manson murders were drawn right away. Gun sales and the purchase of guard dogs went through the roof. And the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office really couldn't blame the public because to them, that secret note they knew about that was from the killer read like a manifesto, and they really expected more murders to follow, and quickly. Investigators started looking into local hippies and then investigating Dr. Ota's business dealings.
The first real lead in the case came the day after the murders. Just hours after the victims had been found and the missing vehicle description was blasted on the news, the calls began coming in. First, someone reported seeing the green Oldsmobile at a gas station in Bonnie Doon, a town not far from Santa Cruz. The caller told the police that a guy in a green Oldsmobile had stopped to fill up, but it was late at night, so he couldn't see the driver very well. This gas station attendant told the driver that they were out of gas, but he referred him to a place down the road that he could try. The driver of this Oldsmobile responded, "That's cool, man," and drove away. The witness told police that the driver was alone, and while he couldn't really see his face, he believed he would recognize the driver's voice if he heard it again. It was good information, but it wasn't really a good lead. They couldn't even prove that the car this gas station attendant had seen had even been Virginia's. But they did know it had been not long after the fire had been set at the Ota house.
Then police got another call, and this one was a bit more urgent. Apparently, someone had driven a green Oldsmobile onto some local train tracks, down into a train tunnel, and then set it on fire and left. An oncoming Southern Pacific switch engine train was traveling through the area at 20 miles per hour when it happened upon it. The engineer said he slowed the locomotive and then used it to push the car out of the tunnel. Police responded to the scene and were able to confirm it was in fact Virginia Ota's missing Oldsmobile. There was damage to the car left by the train and the fire. And as investigators searched around the area, they found several sets of footprints indicating more than one person had been walking in that area, including someone who was barefoot. Investigators took plaster castings of the prints for future comparison.
Police then canvassed the area and tried to speak with every potential witness that they could find. Several people reported seeing a group of three individuals, two men and a woman, who had been camping in the area where the car was found. They were described as having long hair and being in their early 20s. After learning that, a manhunt ensued with mounted police and other officers searching the surrounding woods, but nothing turned up. Running out of leads, investigators then turned their energy to focus back on that note, hoping that there could be some hidden clues that might help to identify the writer. They focused on the mysterious four knights who were signed at the bottom of the note. And after asking around, they finally found something that matched. Each knight could be found in a deck of tarot cards.
So we did some basic research, and here's what we found those four cards are said to represent. The Knight of Wands is bold and courageous, willing to venture into unknown territories to further a mission, not caring if danger lies ahead. The Knight of Cups is described as a messenger who rules with his heart instead of his head, choosing a decision that isn't logical.
The Knight of Pentacles is depicted by a knight holding an object with a pentagram on it. Now, this knight is said to envision a goal and then stick to their path with methodical and relentless focus. And finally, the Knight of Swords is said to be a reminder to be assertive in getting what you want. The traits and meanings that the face value of these cards suggest all have a common theme, belief in carrying out and completing a certain mission.
The note that was found at the murder scene said that the knights were determined to inflict a penalty of death on anyone caught harming the environment. Police were determined to catch them before the next murder, which sounded inevitable. But they were still conflicted about releasing information on the note. It could help to identify the writers, but it could also cause the public to panic and would undoubtedly create even more tension between the straights and the hippies.
Santa Cruz is located only 70 miles south of the hippie mecca that was San Francisco during this time period, and so a large number of them settled in the more quiet and subdued coastal town. But there quickly became a rift between the two cultures. The straights, who had more capitalistic viewpoints and who believed in hard work and ownership, and the hippies, who were more along the socialist beliefs of community living and community property. Now, this was on full display at the funerals of the victims. When Dorothy Cadwaladr was laid to rest, the reverend who spoke at her funeral fanned the flames of this division.
The reverend referred to them as people with no morality and who were part of a new culture, which was essentially a drug culture. He asked those in attendance not to blame God, but to instead place the blame on the shoulders of a diseased, decadent, and depraved society.
This statement reflected the sentiment of the public in the battle of short hairs versus long hairs. And as this opinion was so blatant, police feared that if the public read the note left the crime scene, then it would lead to an all-out culture war. The mayor of the city had been hearing rumors that if the police didn't do something to arrest those responsible for the Otah massacre, then the town would form their own vigilante committee and handle the problem themselves.
The police realized that if they didn't catch the killer soon, then the situation could get a lot worse. And at this point, they had no weapon, no suspect, and no real motive aside from that cryptic manifesto. So they decided to release the note, and it was published in the newspapers a couple of days after the massacre. Almost immediately, the calls started coming in. One at 3 a.m. from a man who wanted to talk to the district attorney immediately and in secret.
So DA Peter Chang and the detectives agreed to meet with the caller. His name was Roger Crone, and he worked at the Catalyst. Now, everyone in the area knew about the Catalyst. It was a hangout where, at one point in time, all walks of life had converged, from lawyers, professors, and hippies to the everyday Joe. But in recent years, the hippies had begun to make the Catalyst their hub. Everyone now knew it as a hippie hotspot. Roger told them that in the last few days, someone had been calling the Catalyst and making bomb threats, and Roger seemed to believe that it was tied to the massacre.
Then Roger mentioned something that really threw the investigation into full gear. He told them about a regular customer who stopped by the Catalyst every day. Roger thought this guy was crazy, and he said that he had this look in the eye that unnerved him. And he also said the way the guy talked sounded a lot like the note that was written, and he was always referring to himself as the Four Knights. Roger said the guy always wanted to hang out and smoke some pot, and Roger had actually taken him up on it once or twice, but then the guy had spent the whole time talking about how he was the chosen one and meant to start a revolution. Roger thought the guy was just way too intense, and so he stopped hanging out with him.
Now, this guy's name was John Frazier, and while he used to come to the Catalyst every day, Roger said that he hadn't been by since a day or two before the massacre. Armed with a name, police got to work learning anything they could about Frazier. They learned he was a white guy with a beard and shoulder-length sandy blonde hair, usually parted and combed off to the side. They found out he was a 24-year-old SoCal local and a bright kid who had dropped out of high school only a few weeks into his freshman year. They obtained tax and Department of Labor records and saw that within the last year, he had been employed at an auto body shop. When they went over to go speak to that manager, he told them that Frazier had just one day up and quit the job. He described Frazier as a good, clean-cut man, a hard worker who was married and had a kid. Before they left, the manager gave the police an address he had on file for Frazier.
When investigators arrived at that address, Frazier's wife answered the door. Dolores Frazier told detectives that she had actually separated from her husband several months before, and she had helped him move into a small old cabin on his mother's property. Police gleaned a lot of insight from this conversation. Dolores said that John had been a great husband and stepfather to her daughter until about 5 months earlier when he got into a car accident. After that, she said everything changed. John started reading the Bible incessantly and began using hallucinogens.
Now, the two had met some years prior. Dolores was working at a snack bar at the mechanic shop where Frazier worked, and she was instantly attracted to him, but she was already married. They started getting to know each other, and she began giving him rides home every day as he didn't have a car. Their relationship blossomed, and they began dating in secret. Eventually, on one of those rides, Frazier told her he needed to get something off of his chest, and he said that after he told her, she was probably going to leave him. He said that he had once killed someone. He went on to explain that he saw a man raping his friend's sister at a park, He ran up, pulled the guy off of her, and slammed his head into the sidewalk until he died. He was then arrested for excessive force.
Now, police looked into this story, but found that Frazier had never been arrested for excessive force or anything relating to an incident like what he had described. But what's interesting is that Dolores didn't know that, and she told police that the story didn't change her opinion of Frazier. In fact, she had fallen in love with him and then told her husband that she wanted a divorce. Eventually, she and Frazier married, and she told police that things were good for a while. But then, she reiterated, about 5 months before the police came knocking, he had gotten into a car accident and everything changed. She said he came home that day and told her that he had rear-ended another car. She had seen that he had a bump on his head, but other than that, he seemed fine. But then quickly afterward, his entire personality changed and he became aggressive. He quit his job, saying he would never again work on a car because they were bad for the environment.
Police later learned that the moment Frazier's head impacted with the dashboard, he started hearing voices. The first thing he heard was a voice saying, "You will die if you continue driving." During this time, Dolores' friend Allison had been living with them, and after the accident, Frazier sat the two of them down and spoke to them for 6 hours straight, never letting them say a single word. Over the 6 hours, he went on to tell them a story about how he had been born in India 10 generations ago, and he was sent to the earth to save it from destruction. When police spoke to Allison, she told them that after the accident, Frazier always wore sunglasses, even inside, claiming he was protecting his eyes so the devil couldn't get in through them.
After that, Frazier started telling people that John's revelations, detailed in the Bible, were written directly for him and only him. And he would rant about how everyone needed to leave their homes because that's where the devil lives, and that people needed to live out in the woods, stop driving cars, and put an end to polluting the earth. One friend told police that around the time he quit his job, he stopped wearing shoes and started wearing a strange symbol around his neck. He became obsessed with the environment and was fixated on the rich and how they were damaging it.
Frazier started getting obsessive over Dolores, refusing to let her even make phone calls. He demanded that she tell him every word that she had spoken to anyone throughout the day. He was convinced that people were plotting against him in an attempt to get him admitted to the hospital or a psych ward. He told her he didn't want anyone finding out what he had inside his head. Then, just a few days before police had come looking for John, Dolores said he had just up and left. It was Saturday when she watched him pack up a knapsack with food and water and put a loaded pistol in his waistband. He handed her his wallet with his driver's license and a pack of tarot cards and said he wouldn't be needing them anymore. His final haunting words to her had been, "Something big is going to happen on Monday."
Eventually, even more disturbing details would come out about John Frazier. He wet the bed into adulthood up until he was married. When he was young, he was said to have poured kerosene on a cat and then set it on fire. Now, if you know anything about the McDonald Triad, the three behaviors in childhood that indicate future violent tendencies as an adult, then you can see Frazier certainly showed all three traits. Frazier had ended up in foster care as a child and had had bad relationships with several of his foster parents. At one point, he stole a gun from one of his foster families and ran away. He was then found living out in the woods and was apparently using that gun to kill animals for food.
He got into his first legal trouble at the age of 10 when he was arrested for shoplifting, and from there, his crimes only escalated. He eventually landed himself on juvenile probation, and he even served time at California's Youth Authority, where he began rebelling against instructors. For the police, all of those details were painting a picture of a man with an unsettling childhood, primed for aggression in adulthood, and he was now hearing voices.
Dolores told police about an old converted milk barn that was located on his mother's property where he was staying. It was up in the hills on a rural plot of land. His mother lived in a trailer and rented out half a dozen other structures there to local college students and hippies. The structure was located across a makeshift drawbridge at the end of a dirt road. Once the police located it, they realized it was less than a mile from the Ota home where the murders had taken place. There was really only a heavily wooded canyon separating the two places. Frazier wasn't there when officers arrived, so they set up surveillance outside. Newspaper reports say officers hid in the brush for nearly 20 hours until Frazier eventually showed up. They watched him go inside, and once they had the green light to move in, they burst in after him. They found him sleeping, and they surrounded him at gunpoint.
Once he woke up and realized what was happening, Frazier reportedly yelled, "Give me what I deserve," indicating he wanted the cops to shoot him. But they didn't, and they were able to take him into custody without incident. When they searched the decrepit building, it didn't take long. It was only 6 feet by 6 feet, and extremely sparse. They were looking for the murder weapons, but they only came away with a pair of binoculars and a knife that Frazier had on him. Later, police showed the binoculars to Tora, the oldest of the Ota daughters, and she immediately recognized them. She said they belonged to her father, and he had actually realized that they were missing weeks before he was murdered.
Now, obviously, that told police that Frazier had been inside the Ota house before. It seemed that he might have been stalking the family. After canvassing the neighborhood, some of the neighbors reported to police that they had seen a man that matched Frazier's description in the weeks leading up to the massacre. And this person was seen climbing a nearby water tower and different trees around the area, where he would then stay for hours, looking through binoculars in the direction of the Ota's residence.
And then more disturbing information came to light. At least two other men who had been living on different parts of his mother's property came forward to police. One of them recalled smoking pot with Frazier before the murders. He said Frazier went on and on about a revolution that he was going to start in the coming weeks. Frazier apparently talked about killing people for it, and specifically mentioned the families that lived on the hill above his mother's property, saying he would, quote, snuff them out.
Frazier had also talked about breaking into a house that was next door to the Ota mansion. He had planned to murder the couple who lived there and broke in during the day. While he waited for them to come home, he looked through the house and found at least two guns, a .38 and .22 caliber, the same calibers that were used in the massacre. Frazier reportedly waited for hours inside their home, but the couple didn't return. Eventually, he got tired of waiting and left, taking those guns with him.
After his arrest, Frazier's mother was quoted as saying her son didn't commit the crimes that he was being accused of. A search of the property didn't locate either of the murder weapons. The only thing of note that was found in that shack were those binoculars and the knife. And there was no indication that a knife had been used during any of the murders. At this point, everything the investigation had learned was just circumstantial. The only physical evidence they had was the binoculars that belonged to Dr. Ota, but that only put Frazier in the house before the crimes were committed, as it was clear they had been stolen prior to the massacre. The only real witness they had was that gas station attendant, the one who had called police, telling them he had a conversation with a man in a green Oldsmobile after the massacre happened. Once police had identified Frazier as their suspect, they called the witness back and asked him to come in, where they conducted a blind voice lineup. It included a series of men saying, "That's cool, man." And the attendant picked out the voice of John Frazier.
Frazier was read his rights and booked into the jail around 8 a.m. He was assigned a public defender who met with him almost immediately. Meanwhile, investigators remained skeptical that he could have pulled off the murder of five people at once on his own. Plus, there had been those different sets of footprints that had been found near Virginia's abandoned car, and the eyewitnesses who saw a small group of people nearby before the car was found. It wouldn't be until Frazier was sent in for a psychological evaluation that police would get their answers.
It came out that Frazier had arrived at the Ota house around noon, the day of the massacre, and no one was home. So he spent the next couple of hours making himself comfortable, drinking beer, going through the home, and laying out his plans. He found a bunch of silk scarves, and he started tying them together to make longer strips of material that he planned to use to bind his victims. Police pieced together a timeline for the victims themselves. Dr. Ota had spent his day at the office, making a lunchtime stop at a local travel agency to confirm the family's upcoming plans to spend Thanksgiving in Hawaii, before he then headed back to work. Little did he know when he got back to his office. At that point, it was believed Frazier was already sitting inside his home. Virginia Ota was last seen stopping at a bank around 2:15 that afternoon, and it's believed that she went straight home afterwards.
Police believe that's when Frazier encountered his first victim. Virginia was still wearing her driving gloves when her body was found, so it's likely he approached her and held her at gunpoint as soon as she walked in the door. Frazier made her lay down on the ground, and then he tied her up using scarves. It would come out that Virginia pleaded with him and said she was due to go to pick up her son Derek, trying to rationalize that he would be waiting all alone with no one to get him. And apparently, this worked in some way because Frazier called Dr. Ota's office number and spoke with the secretary, Dorothy. He told her that someone needed to pick up Derek, as Miss Ota was unable to. He then abruptly hung up and cut the phone line. He left Virginia tied up and went around the house and cut the cord to every phone inside.
Dr. Ota picked up Taggart, and as Dr. Ota's secretary, Dorothy not only ran his office, but she often helped out the family. So she went and picked up 12-year-old Derek herself and drove him back to the house. When they walked in, they encountered Frazier, who then ordered them to lie down. He then tied them up, too. It was about 6 p.m. that night when Dr. Ota and his youngest son, 11-year-old Taggart, came home after making a visit to see one of the grandparents who lived nearby. They were likely controlled and given the same commands as Dorothy and Virginia when they walked inside the door. Frazier had been able to single-handedly overpower 5 victims because they had all come home at different times. Once they were all under control and blindfolded with silk scarves, he spent hours with them inside the house.
He told them that God had spoken to him and that he was there on his behalf. Frazier said he had been instructed to come to their house to speak with the head of the household and present them with a simple decision. They had to decide whether or not they would join God's army. This would mean destroying all of their earthly possessions. They would then have to follow Frazier to the neighbor's house, where they would then be given the same choice, God's army or death.
To show his cooperation, Frazier told Dr. Ota that he had to help him set fire to everything in his home. And he spent a long time trying to convince Dr. Ota to comply with this request. Finally, Dr. Ota told him that he would do whatever he wanted, and he offered Frazier cash and anything else in the house as long as he would just leave him and his family alone. Dr. Ota couldn't have known, but this was the statement that sent Frazier over the edge. He ranted about how materialistic Dr. Ota and his family were and how they were part of the problem. Frazier took Dr. Ota outside, and he sat him down on his knees next to the pool. When Dr. Ota refused to help him set fire to the house and try to return the land to its natural state, Frazier pushed him into the pool. When Dr. Ota started to climb out, Frazier shot him 3 times in the back with a .38 caliber firearm.
Frazier then went back to the house and brought both Virginia Ota and Dorothy Cadwalader outside to the pool. He asked them if they believed in God, and they both said yes. He said then they had nothing to fear, and he shot them both execution style in the neck with the .22 caliber gun before also pushing them in the pool. The boys were still alive back inside the house. Frazier later said that at this point, he didn't want to kill them. He asked God to spare the children, but he believed that God told him that sins of the father are passed on to the sons. And so Frazier shot and killed Derek and Taggart and put them in the pool too. After this, he went to the front of the house. Frazier had walked to the home, so he didn't have a getaway vehicle. So he took Virginia's Oldsmobile, and he drove it partially down the driveway. Then he returned to the house. He moved Dorothy's vehicle to one driveway to block the entrance. And then he moved Dr. Ota's vehicle to the other entrance to block access. He then placed the note under the windshield of Dr. Ota's Rolls Royce. And then he started the fires in several different parts of the house, and finally headed out, driving away in Virginia's Oldsmobile. By the time he was arrested a few days later, the case had become a major story. It was so sensational that more than 500 people gathered outside the sheriff's office when the announcement was made of his arrest. The sheriff actually had to use a bullhorn to project his voice to the crowd because it was so big.
As the case readied for trial, Frazier's defense team hired a psychologist to examine Frazier's mental health. Over a series of at least 15 meetings, Frazier would go in depth about something called the Organization. It was a shadowy group made up of 3 people who he claimed had threatened him and his family. They were the ones who actually committed the massacre, he said. Frazier admitted that he was at the Ota property that night, but claimed he never entered the house. The psychologist testified that the phrase occult philosophy best described Frazier's views, and that he had droned on and on about his ideology, telling the doctor he was willing to go to the gas chamber. Frazier apparently never expressed any emotion over the lives that he stole.
3 months after his arrest, Frazier was able to break a blade off of a razor, and he used it to cut his wrists. But he wasn't trying to end his life. Instead, he used the blood to write the words pigs and freedom across his cell walls. It was all very Manson-esque. Eventually, four experts hired by the defense would describe Frazier as a paranoid schizophrenic. Two hired by the state would say he had psychopathic tendencies but was sane. Frazier had pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity and was indicted by a grand jury and found to be competent to stand trial. And so his trial moved forward. But given the massive publicity in the case, his attorney fought for a change of venue, arguing that hostility toward long-haired people would make a fair trial impossible. And the judge agreed, so the trial was moved to Redwood City, about 50 miles north in San Mateo County.
Frazier's trial started almost 1 year to the day of the murders. Security was tight. D.A. Chang had a big job to do, as he was tasked to provide an almost entirely circumstantial case to this jury. Witnesses to whom Frazier had made incriminating statements testified. Prosecutors laid out the fact that Frazier had the opportunity, based on the close proximity of his shack in the Otah Mansion. He had the means, based on the testimony claiming that he stole two firearms from the neighbor's house before the massacre, which was substantiated by the police reports of the stolen firearms. And finally, he had the motive. Well, according to Frazier, he was trying to rid the world of materialism and those who polluted the environment.
The physical evidence came down to the binoculars and the knife. The knife had since come back from the lab, and traces of copper were found on the blade. It was consistent with the wiring and the telephone cords that had been cut. Frazier's legal team focused their defense on the fact that the case was purely circumstantial. The murder weapons had never been found, the testimony about his previous statements were hearsay, and this client was crazy. John actually thought he was John from the Bible.
And the jury took their time deciding what to do here, because they deliberated for 3 days. In the end, they found Frazier guilty of murder in all 5 deaths. The next step was the sanity and penalty phase. And this was a death penalty case. Again, the defense presented the argument that his client was insane. And when Frazier showed up to court, everyone stopped and stared. He had shaved everything off of half his face and head. One side had long blonde hair, one eyebrow, and part of a mustache and beard. And the other side was completely bare. He certainly looked crazy for the jury, who was about to decide if he actually was. The defense called in 3 psychiatrists to testify to Frazier's mental state in an attempt to get him committed to a mental hospital instead of jail. And he had an expert testify that from the LSD he had taken, it likely permanently affected his brain. But in the end, the jury handed down a sentence of death.
In news reports, Frazier was described as relaxed and aloof throughout the trial. He even turned his back on the judge during his sentencing hearing. Now, the judge who gets the final say ruled the death penalty was justified. After his sentence was handed down and he was escorted out of the courtroom, he walked past a gaggle of reporters. One of them asked Frazier how he felt about the sentence. And as he walked by, Frazier responded with, "Oh, I don't know. What sentence?" And then he laughed. The DA was quoted as saying if he hadn't received the death penalty, it would have shortchanged everybody else on death row. Meaning that crimes don't get much worse or more cold-blooded than this one. Frazier was sent to San Quentin's death row to await the gas chamber. 2 weeks after his sentence, his defense attorney held a press conference and brought Frazier along. When his attorney was asked if Frazier was actually insane, he told them he was, according to the public's established values. When Frazier addressed the press, he finally admitted responsibility for the massacre, saying that he regretted it, but it had set him free of something that had been tormenting him for 22 years. About a year after the trial in 1972, both murder weapons were found. D.A. Chang had been speaking with one of the psychologists who interviewed Frazier. He had already been convicted by this point, but in their conversation, the psychologist mentioned that Frazier had told him he had thrown the guns down a hill on his mother's property. Investigators went out and searched the area, and sure enough, they found the .22 and .38 caliber guns that had been discarded down a steep ravine. Fortunately, Frazier had been convicted at trial without them.
In 1972, the death penalty was repealed when the California Supreme Court determined that it was cruel and unusual punishment. Now, this invalidated Frazier's sentence, and so he was resentenced, this time receiving a sentence of 7 years to life in prison. Life without parole was not an option at the time, and after serving his minimum sentence, he would become eligible for parole. The OTAW's youngest daughter, Lark, had said she didn't even support the death penalty when it came to Frazier. She said it would have made her sad, and she believed that he had been a truly damaged person to have been able to kill a child. After serving his minimum sentence, Frazier became eligible for parole, and it came up every 7 years. He continued to be denied. However, he eventually just stopped showing up to them. He seemed to have not cared whether or not he was going to make parole. And in 2009, at the age of 62, he hung himself inside his jail cell.
In the aftermath of the massacre, Dr. Ota, Virginia, Derek, and Taggart were laid to rest. I can't imagine what it was like for the surviving family to have to endure a quadruple funeral. Their service was at that time the largest in county history, with more than 1,000 people who went. Dorothy's funeral was also big. It brought in hundreds of people paying their respects. She was put to rest next to her young son. Sadly, the aftershocks of Frazier's heinous crimes continued to cause harm within the Ota family. A few months after the murder, Tora married her high school sweetheart, but they divorced within a couple of years. She married again and had a daughter, but 7 years after the massacre, Tora took her own life. Newspaper reports say she had been in and out of mental health facilities, battling severe depression since the murders of her family. She was buried next to her parents and brothers. 2 years after that, Dr. Ota's mother also ended her life.
At this point, the sole remaining family member of the Ota family, Lark, considered herself lucky. She was 15 years old at the time most of her family was stolen from her. Afterwards, she was given the opportunity to live with her grandmother, who was living in town. But Lark recognized that she needed to get away from the area, and so her best friend's family up in Sacramento took her in. She said that because her friend's parents treated her like she was their own daughter, that she was able to get through the dark times that life had dealt her. In 1990, she told the Chronicle, quote, "I heard that the killer felt that my parents were capitalist pigs who raped the environment and needed to die. Yeah, my dad had expensive cars, but he cared about other people. He cared for their eyes for free if they couldn't pay." End quote.
Lark went on to get married and have 4 children, including 2 sons born a year apart, just like her little brothers were. And she named her eldest son, Derek Taggart, to keep their memory alive. Lark was asked, "Don't you want to put all of this away and behind you?" And she responded, "How could something that big in your life go away? If you don't talk about it, it's like it never happened. Like my family wasn't real." And we agree.
Dorothy Cadwaladir, Dr. Victor Ota, Virginia Ota, Derek Ota, and Taggart Ota did not deserve to die.
But they deserve to be remembered.
If you are struggling with thoughts of self-harm or are in crisis, we ask that you please reach out. Someone is waiting to help you through whatever you are facing. Call or text 988.
That does it for today's episode, Sleuths. Thanks for listening. Don't forget that we post the case photos that go along with our episodes to our social media sites. Just visit 2Sleuths on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter to see photos of the victims, the crime scenes, and even old newspaper articles, plus more. We'll see you next week for another episode.
Until then, stay vigilant.
And stay curious, fellow sleuths.